Mr. President, status control on Jupiter 2. As of this moment, the spacecraft has passed the limits of our galaxy. It's presumed to be hopelessly lost in space.
Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard. Our guest today is Dr. Margaret Weidekamp, author of Space Craze, America's Enduring Fascination with Real and Imagined Spaceflight. Folks, this is a fantastic episode. Get ready to want to watch everything on streaming and plan a trip to Washington, D.C. All right. Hi, Dr. Weidekamp. Welcome to Retro Rockets. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Of course. I'm delighted to be here. My name is Margaret Weidekamp. I'm the chair of the Space History Department at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. And in addition, I'm a curator in the curatorial department here, and I am in charge of our social and cultural history of spaceflight collection, which includes our memorabilia of the actual space program, as well as our space science fiction objects.
That was like the best advertisement for the museum I've ever heard, can I just say?
It is a wonderful place to get to work and a remarkable collection to get to be in contact.
Last year, you had a book that came out. It's called Space Craze, America's Enduring Fascination with Real and Imagined Spaceflight. What made you interested in researching and writing on that topic?
You know, honestly, this is the book that I wish somebody else had written almost 20 years ago when I began this job at the museum. I just saw so many connections between how spaceflight had been imagined and how spaceflight had been executed. And the more that I was looking at those things, the more that I was trying to elucidate, what does it tell us about the time, about the 30s, about the 50s, about the 80s, about the 60s? And pulling all of that together over the next, 15 or so years really was the chance to put that down on paper. And so Space Craze in some ways is curators behind the scenes walkthrough of this social and cultural collection and trying to really show people the connections that I'm seeing between that imagination and execution and the way that Americans' excitement about spaceflight has really persisted because it's been flexible, because it's been able to adapt to new times. And I just think it's a fascinating story and one that the objects, the artifacts really tell quite well.
What was the most surprising thing that you came across while you were putting the book together?
So at the end of the book project, when I was actually working with Smithsonian Books, who published it, which you would think would be an easier get since I'm at the Smithsonian, but I pitched them for 6-9 months, just like every other writer out there to get their attention. And they came back to the book and said, we'd really like you, instead of at the end, kind of vaguely waving your hands and saying, and more unto the present, really dig into that and write us a full chapter that runs basically from the beginning of the 20th century up to the present day. And what was both surprising and very reassuring and delightful was that the arcs that I had been writing from the beginning, starting in the late 1920s, up to the kind of, and then the hand wave to the present, when you really dug into recent years, those trends that I was seeing were even more true in recent years. And it's always gratifying when the arguments that you're making turn out to really work all the way through the book, right up to the bitter end. But I was writing, the book was due on a Monday, and the Halo television series was announced during a big Sunday afternoon football game at the end of the season in January. And that became one of the last paragraphs that I was writing, like, this is due tomorrow, and here's new information that was just unembargoed as of the last 15 minutes, and I'm going to try to cram it into the book. So I would say that's kind of my most surprising and reassuring thing, was seeing that this all held together and the stories that I was telling and the arc that I was defining from the beginning of the book really did hold up all the way through the end. And when you look at the state of current spaceflight, especially this explosion of popular culture and commercial spaceflight, it really fits with what I'm talking about in Space Grace.
Yeah, they really, the two topics, they really do talk to each other so much. It really is a conversation. The materials and the physics that we have, and the fantastical stories that we're telling, which are in turn inspiring engineers to to figure out, you know, more futuristic materials. And it's, you know, I have to believe that so many people that are involved with space flight now were just like me, you know, watching Star Trek and watching Star Wars and, you know, playing with little plastic spaceships. And then we all grew up.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the Apollo astronauts, they really started as jet test pilots, but even they were reading the Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon comic strips and listening to those radio programs. And whether that inspired them to get into the space field, it certainly was something that they had as their reference point when they got a chance to get into the space field. And what we now know is that more and more of the people who you talk about grew up as children of the shuttle program, or grew up watching Star Wars, or grew up watching Star Trek, and were excited about those visions of what was going to be possible and wanted to get involved and try to make that future happen. So I thought that it was really important to look at that inspirational piece, but also at the stories that science fiction tells us about who should be doing the exploring, and then the ways that the actual space program is reflecting those same cultural social contracts.
I'm happy you mentioned that specifically of who should be doing this, and because it has changed beautifully over the decades. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
So one of the things that I was really looking at is what I call the Buck Rogers archetype, which is this kind of vision of space exploration that's defined by Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon in the late 20s and 1930s about who should be doing the exploring. And as another part of that, I was looking at the alien, who's held at arm's reach, who's the other, who's the different, and how that changes over time. And so it's something that is kind of relentlessly white and heterosexual and adventurous and really tapping into these old Western ideas about exploration of the frontier in the 30s and even into the 1950s, but something like Star Trek's vision of men and women of different races and even a half alien going to explore the universe together starts to really change that. And it continues to change as in conversation with the civil rights movement, the second wave of the women's movement, all of these other changes that are happening. So you get something like the 1978 class of astronaut candidates at NASA, that group of 35 that includes the first six women astronaut candidates, three African-American men and an Asian-American man. And then from there, even more international collaboration, and the fictional visions also then take off in whole new directions. So if anyone has watched The Expanse, that is a set of stories that were started by a pair of authors who explicitly said, we're not just going to write white guys in space. And so are thinking about what's that vision of who we are as we go out and adventure in space.
I'm a big fan of The Expanse. So as you were saying that, in my mind, I'm seeing all my favorite characters.
Well, and you start to move from just, you know, a strong female character to like a whole scenes that end up between women because they're organically powerful parts of the story and not just the love interest with a lot of adventure, but who has a distressing tendency to be captured. Right. That, you know, which was the kind of type that you got from that Western model in the early years. And so it's nice to see that in fiction explored and deliberately played against and what you can do with that. And then in the reality of actual spaceflight, to see more women coming to the front of the line in terms of job assignments. So we've seen the first all-women spacewalk not because it was kind of a very special episode at NASA where they were trying to do something nice, but because those were the qualified astronauts who were next in line to do a job that they were highly trained to do. And so being able to see how that's playing out as you're starting to look at Artemis and going back to the moon, really thinking about what's going to be next in real space exploration in terms of commercial spaceflight, it's interesting to see this change happening slowly, a little more slowly than, you know, we've had 600 people in space and 60 women.
It's a little slower than we had wanted.
Not quite 50%, but you've got a long legacy there that skews those numbers, and really talented people who are continuing to clamor to be a part not only of the astronaut corps going into space, but of all of the ground teams that are really making these things happen.
And it's, you know, you have to think about where we are now. We've got, we have women astronauts now, and that's what kids need to see.
And women flight controllers and women engineers and, you know, and people of most of this work anymore is really being done by these large teams of very diverse people who are bringing their talents together. And I think there's an awareness that you want to really foster that in order to take best advantage of the talents that are available.
That's just wonderful. While you were putting the book together and deciding what was going to go in there and what maybe wouldn't make it in there, I want to ask about if you had any pieces that didn't make the final edit, or were there things that you realized afterwards, hey, I really wish I could have included that?
I think there were definitely places where I had six really good examples to make a point, and the editor was pointing out that one or two would really make the point just as well. And so those are some difficult cuts to make to decide to, in the 1950s television section, you know, skip lightly across a number of different places instead of really digging into. But I've watched episodes of each of these shows, and there's such great content there. The challenge of the book, honestly, was that I felt like every few pages was its own deep dive research project into this 1950s television show or this movie from the 70s or this part of the space shuttle program and what was happening with these particular missions. And then trying to, out of that, make sure that I was really keeping an eye on the overall change over time that I was really trying to walk the reader through. And the connection to the artifacts. So I start this book as a museum curator working with the collection and with access to that collection. That skews a little bit what we do, but it also leads, it allows me to tell some unusual stories and with a little bit of greater depth. So I think that was part of the balance of this, was trying to figure out when I was leaving things on the cutting room floor as well. There are many different TV shows and movies and different, lots of literary stuff that doesn't necessarily fit in the book, because I tend to start with objects and literary things don't necessarily produce memorabilia the way that TV shows or movies do. So that's part of it. I feel like talking to people about the book has often been an exercise in, but what about, and people pull out their favorite thing, and it's really 50-50 on whether it made it into the book. It's a much better percentage that I actually worked on it and researched it, but it's about 50-50 that it's in there.
I did notice that. I was reading some sections and I could tell there's a lot more here. I feel like there probably was, you know, if not a handful more paragraphs than pages. And, you know, nobody wants to publish a 1,200-page book, so I absolutely understand cutting it down a bit.
It had to be the one volume, and it can't be a four-volume set in a slipcase of, like, all of my and examples.
Would you ever consider doing another volume?
I think that I will probably have a folder somewhere where I start accumulating the things that have continued to happen since the book came out, even just in the last couple of years, because things are changing quite so fast. And I think I will always have a set of examples in the back of my head that I would have done more with that, given a chance to really dig into it. There's just a lot of great roles. We're adding continually to the collection, so there's new objects that I would be interested in talking about. And And that's part of the challenge of this is because, and I try to set it out from the beginning of the book, because I'm looking at how spaceflight has been depicted as well as executed, that often, and how that has been materialized in things, then that often skews what my focus is. You know, the joke in the book is, you know, there aren't that many Isaac Asimov action figures, right? So I don't get necessarily to dig into the Ray Bradbury of the Isaac, you know, the many powerful visions of Mars and planetary life and all kinds of things that would be interesting and tangential and that are related and that would be great fun, but trying to keep the focus on how have people been excited or not about spaceflight and why has that really recurred as a theme in American culture, because it tells these powerful stories about who we tell ourselves that we are as explorers and why that has been such a powerful vision for imagining and also a driver for executing.
There's absolutely something to be said for Isaac Asimov action figures, but I really did appreciate that you stayed so focused on what is visual, what is physical, what radio shows were people listening to, what television shows were people watching, what movies were people watching, what physical artifacts do we have? And I liked those connections between what we're seeing versus what now can we touch because of what we saw. So I enjoyed that focus.
Thank you. I felt like one of the sub-themes of the book became just explaining the forms of popular culture in the 20th and 21st century. Try to explain to people who might not have gone to a movie palace in the 1950s or 1930s what that experience was like, or even just trying to explain television used to turn off. It only had so many channels that, you know, in the middle of the night, if you woke up after, you know, midnight or 1 a.m., you would be looking at snow and there were no more channels to watch and you went to bed. And looking at then, you know, what does that do to shape what's possible, right? Very often the answer to why was something this way or that in a TV show or a movie really comes down to its show business. And there's a business model for what they're putting together. And within that, people are doing tremendously creative envisioning of what could be possible. And so trying to walk people through even the ways that that kind of media used to be physical, right? You used to physically rent a VCR tape, or you used to have a physically have a collection of DVDs that would showed something about what your interests were. Well, and looking at that physical stuff, those physical media was a way that, you know, with streaming, you can't just walk into someone's apartment and know if they're interesting or not by what's on their bookshelves.
You mentioned bookshelves. I'm an absolute snoop when I go to my friends' houses. It's what's on their bookshelves. Mm-hmm. How, you know, do we read the same authors?
And what are they reading? What are they listening to? What right. are they watching?
Yeah. And, what movies do they own? What, you know, how many mm-hmm. seasons of Deep Space Nine do they have on DVD?
Yes.
And I can't do that anymore because everything's digital. I'm not going to say, hey, can I look at your Kindle app on your phone?
Right, right. Show me your streaming and tell me what it suggests for you.
Right, right. So
it's an interesting thing that also there's just at the same time a real golden age of what's available right now, because there's so much money in streaming and being put behind shows that really are coming over with cinematic quality special effects and, you know, writing and thought put into things. So being able to watch the arc of where the Star Trek universe has gone, or what's being produced in the Star Wars universe, or where some of these new shows are coming out, it's really been a fascinating time to be able to follow where that started with radio programs and comic strips and early television, to then be able to follow that arc all the way through cable television into streaming.
You're listening to Retro Rockets. Today, our guest is Dr. Margaret Weidekamp. You can listen to our other episodes at retrorockets.podbean.com. Chat with us on Twitter. We're at RetroRocketsPod. I'm going to be binge watching everything on Netflix. I have Netflix and Prime, so tonight You've inspired me to just binge watch everything.
It's one of the challenges of being it's the lovely thing to get to be a pop culture historian. And there are libraries of television. There are places where you can go and just watch television, but it is you can't skim television. And you can't skim movies. And so the wonderful part is just getting to watch it. And then the kind of agonizing part is how much time it takes in the archive to really go through things. And especially if they've saved something from the 50s, complete with the commercials, then it's, you know, doubly wonderful because you're stopping all through the commercials to take all kinds of notes and look at the fact that, you know, Kellogg's Pep cereal was being advertised by flight test pilots from some of the top aviation companies, and they were running that in the middle of these science fiction television shows. So the connections that I wanted to make between the ways that people were thinking about what was faster and farther and what they were watching was all right there in front of me. So it's a great thing to get to dig into as a scholar.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. The commercials.
The commercials can be particularly wonderful. So you get the on DVD, something like you get the kind of pure form of what the thing was, but a recording of a 1950s television show, if they've saved it with everything. Some of them aren't relevant, but some of them are strikingly relevant and really a wonderful revelation and a glimpse into how people would have watched it at the time.
Yeah, you're watching it in the exact way that someone would have watched it. You know, sure, I can go buy a remastered Blu-ray of, you know, of whatever I want. But I'm watching it today. I don't get to experience it in the way somebody would have watched that television show in 1974.
And part of it is also trying to remember, you know, these shows were originally watched on a glowy little cathode ray tube without the ability to pause something or rewind it or get up. You know, if you walked out of the room, you missed it and it was not going to necessarily be rebroadcast. And so just kind of watching it with an eye towards at the time, those were great special effects if it was just going to flash by you on that kind of low resolution screen. And it really did create a vision that people got very excited about, even if, you know, it doesn't necessarily hold up to a full HD screen now.
It's like any new episode of a TV show that you're excited about. It's something you've never seen before. And just like you said, it may never be on TV again. So it's now or never.
And fans then, science fiction fans in particular, got a real reputation for being passionate, for being active, for being the kinds of folks who wrote to networks and wanted their shows to continue, who wrote to the White House and wanted space shuttles named after their favorite space vehicle, who, you know, would fly a plane over Amazon headquarters to try to get The Expanse an extra season or two and try to, you know, going directly after Jeff Bezos. Just, you know, we know you're a science fiction fan and you have your own streaming service. Please pick this up. So science fiction fans then get this great reputation based on that excitement that they get from watching the newest thing coming out, and the businesses come to kind of count on that, that they're going to be able to use that to draw people to new forms of the media.
Oh, I'm happy to spend my money on all my favorite nerdy fandom things. It's that meme of shut up and take my money.
Yes.
So this is a perfect segue into a lot of my favorite parts of the book were near the end when it talked about a lot of modern fandoms, kind of like 1980s and going forward. I'm a young Gen Xer. I grew up on Next Generation, and then Deep Space Nine, and then, you know, all the Battlestar Galactica watch parties. What were some of your favorite shows and movies?
So I'm the right age to have been a Star Wars kid in the 1970s, and then found Star Trek as I got to be older and became a Next Generation fan, and then found my way back into the original series. I was living in upstate New York in the 1990s and going to graduate school at a time when Star Trek Voyager was being used as the draw for the new United Paramount Network. So you should call your cable provider and get them to put UPN on your cable station so that you could watch the show. And our cable provider declined to do so. And so what we had was I had a colleague whose sister lived in Florida. And once a week, we would get a VHS cassette that showed up in a padded envelope, and it had the last week's episode on it. And I think she had a literal list of who she would pass. You know, I remember getting a phone call at some point. I had a paper due. And I hadn't gotten my episode watched, and the next person in line was bugging her about, like, she needs to
pass. Oh, so she mailed, the VHS got mailed all over the country.
Got mailed to her and then passed around to a list of people on campus who she knew were also fans, and it got stuck on my desk because I had stuff due for school, which is why I was there. So I needed to move it along. So I think, you know, some of the things that have been favorites of mine have been, you know, that becomes a kind of special coveted experience and connects you to folks. And I really had a lot of fun writing about the birth of those fandoms in the 1970s, the way that, you know, Star Trek fandom, it's a well-known story, really starts many of the fan traditions that we enjoy now with cosplay at conventions. Just, you know, connecting with other fans and enjoying that push-pull of, you know, fans are the harshest critics because we love it so much. And so we have that reputation for, but, you know, wanting to get all of the, parse all the details and argue over all of the intricacies of it. That's half the fun of being a fan, is sitting with other fans and dissecting stuff and saying, well, I would have, but they should have. So I think that's been, part of the fun of this and reconnecting with this material, is it does have this wonderful nostalgia. Where were you when you were a part of this part of the story or that part of the story?
You can kind of find your generation when you're at conventions of, how old were you when Voyager started?
Yes.
How old were you when Next Gen started? Like, I remember getting very excited. My dad telling me that this Star Trek show was going to be starting. And, you know, he let me stay up and watch original series that would play at like midnight or something on some channel that we had. And like, that was an activity that my dad and I did together, as we would watch Star Trek The Next Generation.
I hear that a lot from fans, that it became important to them, not only for the storytelling and the power of what they were doing, but also for those connections with a beloved relative, a parent, a sibling, that we used to watch this together. And I do think that there is something special about that sense of kinship and, you know, bonding over a shared love of these kinds of visions of what could be possible.
I'm still hooked on what you mentioned about the Voyager VHS making its way around. I feel like that is the perfect story prompt of, you know, the as the VHS tape makes it around, and as people watch the show, they're putting a piece of paper in the envelope with their comments. And by the time you get to the end, it's like this whole kind of fanzine of that episode.
Yes. Well, and I saw that a number of places in the 1970s where people did used to get these kind of typewritten, you know, typeset newsletters. And then the idea was really not just that you read it, but that you might pass it along to other folks you know who would also like it, who might then, you know, send their dollar and subscribe to that and get it from a particular person. And those connections, I think, are part of the spirit of what you get in even, you know, the biggest, like, Comic-Con, is that sense of, you know, here is the tribe all kind of coming together to enjoy together. And the spirit of that, I think, has these longer roots that many in the fan community remember, but even to the point of, you know, Star Trek convention, science fiction conventions used to provide like childcare in the 70s, at some, you know, because people recognize that sense of community and wanting to, everyone to feel comfortable and be able to be there. And I think that's been an important part of the fan experience, is some sense of that connection.
There was some conventions that I've attended in the past where, as the convention organizers, you know, they start being an organizer when they're in college, and then they're a little bit older. And then they're a little bit older and they have a munchkin in tow. And now suddenly the convention has a kids event. and, yes. you know, has a room, you know, has a room for preschoolers.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what the community needs.
And this has been going on long enough that there are people who remember kind of growing up in those rooms or getting brought to these things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on the real spaceflight side as well, you know, who remember being brought to launches and getting to see that stuff and, you know, bonding over, you know, which autographs did they have from astronauts or what mission patches had they gotten in their collection. Those kinds of things, I think, can be really important connections as well.
So we're talking about the past and we're talking about what we're doing now. But what do you think is next? What do you think the next 20 years holds for spaceflight?
So in real spaceflight, I'm really looking at the ways that so much of what's being done right now has a real awareness of its history and its past. Things like the SpaceX Falcon 9, which is named Falcon for the Millennium Falcon, or Blue Origin's New Shepard and New Glenn vehicles named after Alan Shepard, the first American to go into space on a suborbital flight. So that's the suborbital vehicle, and then the orbital vehicle named after John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth. So I think I'm really looking at the pace of what is changing and happening in terms of real spaceflight, the birth, it seems finally, of a slightly more democratized access to space, no longer just the billionaires able to pay for their seat on a Soyuz to get to the International Space Station, which 11, about a dozen people did. But the idea that, you know, now we have access via SpaceX to be able to, you know, go into space, or via Blue Origin to be able to go into space. So looking at that, and then also kind of these visions that are really looking much farther into the future and thinking about what might be possible and the ways that those are deliberately building on and playing against what some of the conventions of the genre have become. So it's certainly an interesting and exciting time to be paying attention to spaceflight.
It is. When it comes to spaceflight and how fast things are moving, this is the best time to be alive and be watching it.
Mm-hmm.
As we come to the end of our episode, I want to come back to the very beginning of our episode, where you let us know that you curate the Social and Cultural History of Spaceflight collection. I'm a nerd for stuff. So that sounds like an absolute dream job. If you don't mind me asking, what was your career path to get there?
This is not necessarily where I thought I would end up, but it's a wonderful place to have ended up. I started my career as an historian. I was training to be a history professor, and I wrote a book about a women's astronaut testing project from the late 50s, early 1960s. And as a part of the preparation of that, which became Right Stuff, Wrong Sex, I spent a year at the NASA headquarters history office. And really, I'd always been a science fiction fan, as I've said, and had followed the space program as a kid in the 80s, was excited about the space shuttle, but really reconnected with that. And I came back, and as a graduate student, I had created a course called Gender, Race, Society, and Space. And at some level, that's the roughest rough draft of what became Space Craze, which was really looking at everything from Jules Verne through to current science fiction and all of these connections between the stories that are told about who does the exploring, how that gets done, and then, you know, what the expectations are about, you know, who can be the explorer and who is the distant alien. And so this book and my work at the museum really came out of that I had been teaching that class for a few years. I taught women's studies at a small liberal arts college in upstate New York. And then the opportunity to be at the museum came up and the chance to work with this collection. And I just absolutely couldn't pass it up. So moved to Washington and have been finding my way through this job for 19 years coming up at the end of this summer. And this book really is the kind of labor of love of trying to put all of that, distill all of that into things. I think often when there's a curator in your TV show or your movie, that person just knows all the facts. They know everything. And I know a fair amount of things, but I think that really what makes a good curator is asking a ton of questions. And so I open every chapter in Space Craze with me confronting something, some problem, some exhibit I'm trying to build, some artifact I'm trying to figure out, something I'm looking for to bring into the museum. And just asking a ton of questions about how did this get to be the way it is? What story is it telling? And, you know, how can I connect that with the larger stories that we're telling at the museum about actual aviation and actual space flight? And so that's my long, strange path to being a Smithsonian curator and to then trying to bring that experience to readers through Space Craze by kind of walking them through, here's the kinds of things that I'm looking at and the kinds of questions I'm asking and the stories that I think it's telling us about who we are as Americans, as explorers, not as some universal thing, but because it really tells us something uniquely American about ourselves and about where we're going.
You get paid to ask a million questions. That is absolutely the dream job.
It is very fun. And to really, you know, it's a wonderful way to get to go down these various rabbit holes about, you know, what about this radio program or that comic strip or that actual space mission, and then, you know, come up for air having learned entirely too much about this and trying to figure out how to sift that into something that our visitors to the museum will enjoy or that someone reading a book will like.
I know we're going to have listeners that want to learn more about you and your work and are going to want to find out when's the museum open? When can I take my kids? Do you have a website? Where can we find you online? Where do we find some of your collections online?
The National Air and Space Museum is online at Air and Space, spell out the and, airandspace.si.edu. We're not a .com, we're an educational institution. And you can find the things on display at the museum, which we've got half of the museum at the National Mall open right now. And so you need timed tickets to get into that. And we're continuing to work on the other half. We also have the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center, which is out by Dulles Airport, and there's a wonderful collection of space science fiction toys in a case out there right across from the mobile quarantine facility used by Apollo 11, and that's next to the flown space shuttle Discovery, so it's a wonderful place to think about imagination in the context of the real things. I'm on Twitter at MGTWSpace, and I'm in the same for Instagram.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. This has been great.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets. Thank you.